All right, we are live on another edition of the Edlow Podcast. Subscribe, subscribe, subscribe. I probably should at this point. I've done like 130 something episodes and I don't even have intro music, so I should probably get on that. But regardless, here we are. This is another fun one for me. I have Lieutenant Colonel Buzz Patterson, former United States Air Force, and you were a 20-year pilot, but then also worked in the Clinton administration. You've worked all over the world, but ultimately ended up in the Clinton administration, saw many things, actually held the nuclear football for a time.
Yeah.
Your life is fascinating. I'm sure you've got so many stories, some you probably can't even tell.
That's true. I've had a very blessed life, Josh. I really have. Like 20 years in the Air Force as a pilot and flew into and out of 70 countries, combat on multiple occasions. And then, yeah, the White House called me up. I was an operations officer in a squadron in Northern California at Travis Air Force Base. And the White House called and said, would you come out? And I come out and interview for the job. And I didn't even know the job existed. I knew there was a nuclear football, but I hadn't really thought about who carried it or what they did, you know. So I said, sure, I'll fly out. So I flew out. It was a three-day process, interview process. There was me and five other Air Force officers. It was the Air Force's turn to be the senior service in charge of the other four aides. There's actually five aides, well, there's probably six now with the Space Force. When I was there, there were five aides, an Air Force guy, an Army guy, a Marine guy, a Navy guy, and a Coast Guard guy, and girls. I mean, a little bit was mixed there pretty much. And so I flew out there, three-day process. They asked me if I wanted the job, and I said I didn't know. I needed some time to think about it because I was really loving life in Northern California and dating my now wife of 28 years. So so I didn't really know I wanted the job. And Leon Panetta, who was the chief of staff of the White House at the time, called me in my hotel room. You know, I thought I was going to be flying back to Northern California. Called me in my hotel room and said, hey, I know you told us you didn't know if you wanted the job, but if we offer you the job, will you take it? So I said, yes. So I started, I met President Clinton the next morning. I flew back to Northern California, sold my house. I had like 2.5 months to get back to the White House. So I got everything. I was single at the time, so that was great. And yeah, I started carrying the nuclear football for President Clinton in May of 1996.
Wow. You're actually, you know, you're in my stomping grounds. I'm from Sacramento. I live in Sacramento. So Travis Air Force Base is not too far from here. So I'm very familiar. It's a really nice area. So I can understand why you wouldn't want to necessarily move, but it has to feel like an honor to be, even though I know that you got a lot of stuff from that. It has to be an honor to be trusted with a job like that.
Oh, it's amazing. You know, I got to tell you, walking into the White House my first day after I'd actually been hired, I walked in on a beautiful spring morning and I realized that I was a young major in the Air Force and I was working for the most important human being in the world in the most important building in the world. And that was a little gobsmacking, if you can imagine. Plus, I'm carrying the ability to destroy the world. Yeah. So, you know, in my hands. So, yeah, it was an awesome 2 year. I was there exactly 2 years. Every day was a little bit different in the Clinton administration, as you can possibly imagine. We flew all over the globe. I was there with him on Air Force One, Marine One. I had an office in the White House and a bedroom in the White House. I went on with the Clintons on vacations. I was there 24/7 for 2 years. Yeah. And looking back on it, I've written a book about it, but looking back on it now, it was kind of a blur. It was just so intense.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing that I find so interesting. And I'm sure a lot of my listeners, you know, are going to be interested in, and that is that you weren't too thrilled with some of the stuff you saw, when you were there. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, it was, every day, you know, President Clinton and I got along personally very, very well. And Hillary Clinton and I did marginally well. Well, I started seeing chinks in the armor very early on, especially as it applied to our military. I mean, you know, we had the Black Hawk Down situation in Somalia, and we had Osama bin Laden killing Americans and embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. And I just saw his inability to want to be a commander in chief. He was just more a politician in chief. So those kind of things affected me, but I didn't let it affect my job because I was there to serve and support the presidency in the office of the presidency and not particularly a human being. So I did it for 2 years. I wouldn't replace it for anything, but I wouldn't do it again. I can guarantee you that.
Yeah. So was it anything when I know on your bio, you mentioned that you were disgusted and appalled what you personally witnessed. Was that really more to do with the military operations as opposed to anything else?
It was predominantly, that's a good question. Thanks for asking that question, Jeff. Yeah. Josh, predominantly it was the military inactions. And, you know, I tell stories about this in my book, Dereliction of Duty. I had just gotten into the job, and this one story that I was with President Clinton on a professional golf course, a PGA Tour event outside of Washington, D.C. And we, the United States of America, had promised that we were going to support the Kurds in the northern part of Iraq. And you know, ironically, Saddam Hussein was the leader of Iraq at the time. And we had promised our support, Pentagon and military, U.S. military support. But I'm at this golf course with President Clinton. And when you're away from the White House, the military aide becomes the call screener also, in addition to carrying the nuclear football and working with all the military assets and working with Secret Service. They're also the guy that takes the phone call when somebody important calls and wants to talk to the president. And so I received on this particular day in about an hour and a half, we had promised support to the Kurds in northern Iraq. And Saddam Hussein was moving on them and annihilating them, cleansing them in tens of thousands, numbers of tens of thousands. And we had an airstrike lined up. And I knew some of the guys that were in airplanes, U.S. airplanes ready to go and repel the Republican Guard in Iraq and save the Kurds. And three times I approached President Clinton, getting phone calls from the National Security Council, Sandy Berger to be specific, asking me to get the president's go-ahead to launch our attack. And the president was simply too busy to take the phone call three times in a row. So our guys never launched. The Kurds were slaughtered. And I only been in the job maybe 2.5, maybe 3 months. So that was like, oh, my God, this guy is not. I mean, if I had been a commander or the president, I would have said, let's go. We promised it. Let's go. But he didn't do it. That was the first of many.
As somebody who's in the military and you see something like that, I've had a couple of military guys on here. We've talked a lot about mental health issues that come with that.
Yeah.
Do you struggle with that decision? Like, I mean, I know it wasn't your decision, right? But you're there and you're seeing it. Does that, even now, does that affect you in some way? I can hear in your voice, it seems like it's something you really struggle with.
Yeah, of course it does. I mean, and I've got a little PTSD, nothing like the guys that fought on the ground do.
Sure.
But I fought my combat at 30,000 feet, essentially. Sure. So I didn't see guys dying every single day. But it did affect me. And I realized that, you know, but I was sworn to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. And I'm not an Alex Vindman type where I'm going to go up the chain without going through the chain. And I just didn't think it was my job or my role at the time. I felt sorry for the people and I felt sorry for my peers and friends that were in cockpits that wanted to go execute this mission and weren't allowed to. So it was disappointing. And there were several more. So that was just the first one. But yeah, I mean, you know, he would ask me about military policies and philosophies frequently, but I wasn't the deputy joint chief staff or anything. I was a major and then I became a lieutenant colonel while I was there. As I was just there to serve him, and my sworn goal, Josh, was not to get him hurt, not to embarrass him, just make sure that nothing bad happens to the country in the White House.
Mm-hmm. So you serve 2 years, and is there like a term when you do this? Is it like a
term set? Well, it's a 2-year minimum, and some guys and girls extend. I knew one guy that was there 3.5. I wanted to get the hell out of there, quite frankly. I wanted to go back to the Air Force and fly airplanes again. So I didn't fly for those 2 years. I was with him 24/7. So I had stopped flying to take the job. I wanted to go back to fly. I got married during that time. And I just thought, you know, I want to go back to the Air Force and be a normal person and not have to deal with this anymore. And all of, well, with the exception of one, all of my other military service friends and that worked with me agreed. In fact, when I got out of the military, I was the first guy to actually get out of the military. I went to fly for Delta Airlines coming out of the military because our first daughter was born and she had some medical issues. So I got out of the military and I started having some of the other guys that I'd served with call me and say, you know what, you're the only one that can legally talk about this because there's Uniform Code of Military Justice and all that stuff. So you can't do it while you're in uniform or active duty. So when I retired, they all called me and said, hey, man, you got to write a book. You got to tell the real story. And I wrote Dereliction. And I got to be honest with you. I wrote it as objectively as I possibly could. I do tell personal stories, but I don't talk about a lot of the other stuff, Josh. I don't talk about Monica Lewinsky. I don't talk about these affairs. It's just, it's strictly a military officer who served directly and lived with the Clinton administration, sharing my thoughts and beliefs. It's kind of a clarion call, really. It was just not... I didn't think it was going to be a bestseller. I didn't think it was going to be in Rush Limbaugh. It was kind of getting stuff off my chest, right? So that was the entire motivation. And you know, here we are, in 21 years later, and it's still selling, and it's been New York Times bestseller for almost a year. And you know, so I just went right into a whole nother lifestyle right after experience right after the White House and right after the military.
Yeah. You know, there's so many questions I have right there. The first one being, you know, you hear a lot of stories. It's interesting. You say you don't want to talk about Monica Lewinsky and all that stuff. And I respect that. But there is a lot of lore around the Clintons. Yeah. You know, like as I'm sitting here, you start talking before you started talking. And I'm like, how have you not been suicided yet? You know what I mean? Like that kind of thing. In your experience, how much of that lore is just lore? Like from what your experience was, how much of that are they really that ruthless? Because they seem actually like he seems so charming, but we know that like there's a lot of questionable stuff there.
Yeah.
Your experience personally as a guy, like what did you think?
Well, there's a lot of lore, but in my experience, most of it's true. You know, I did really enjoy being around Bill. I mean, he didn't have a moral fiber in his body. And I actually walked in on him one time with Monica Lewinsky in the Oval Office when I was there.
Oh, Saturday afternoon. Hell.
Yes. Yes. That's a story for another day. Maybe. But you know, so I got
another book needs to be written.
What's that?
Another book needs to be written.
Yeah. Well, I'm working on one, but not about the Clintons. So I've got four out there. I'm working on number five right now, but it's more about the Pentagon today and our military and what Biden's doing to destroy it. But you know, I got along with Bill. I mean, you know, first name basis, I would go jogging with him. I'd go to the golf course with them. We would talk college football in the Oval Office. But Hillary was a whole different animal. If you want to talk about somebody that is vindictive and evil, and a lot of the lore that you heard about Hillary, I would say 99% is true.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, I can corroborate about 80% of it. So I got a pretty good feeling most of it's true.
So let me ask you then, just kind of around the situation, because you hear about this stuff a lot in a lot of circles. Like I'm a big wrestling guy. We hear about Vince McMahon right now.
Right.
That is like, as a guy who actually has been backstage at a WWE event working in the back during Royal Rumble, like I am, you know, I'm 6'7", 295. I thought I was going to be a pro wrestler. I ended up being a lawyer. And I am so glad that I wasn't a part of that, just because it's like, I can see in a situation like that, where like you just so desperately want that job and you see that happening and you don't say anything because you're living your dream, right? You don't want to rock the boat. Is that like kind of the way around there with him? Like, did he seem, cause it's, he gotta be pretty bold to do that type of stuff in the Oval Office. Like, you know, tell me about that, like what the feeling was around this, if you guys kind of had an idea of stuff like that was going on.
Oh, we totally did. When I first got there, the Secret Service guys and I were talking and I asked about why this 20-year-old intern had the same access button into the Oval Office that I did as a military aide. And the Secret Service guys were like, hey, man, you don't want to go there. That is presidential best friend material right there. Just stay away from that. So I saw that. But let me tell you another situation I had, Josh, that was probably – so I knew Bill was not a stellar commander in chief. Mm-hmm. And then one time we were coming back on Air Force One from Europe, mm-hmm. and we had been in Europe for like 9 days. We were all tired and ready to get back to D.C. and, you know, I can get back to the White House. And we landed in Washington, D.C. We landed at Andrews, and then we took Marine One over to the South Lawn on the White House. And it was about midnight in D.C. And I remember taking President Clinton to the elevator that goes up into the residence, and, you know, kind of put him to bed a little bit and went to my bedroom, which was downstairs in the East Wing. And my phone rang, and it was the Air Force One chief pilot, a good friend of mine, mm-hmm. Colonel Mark Donnelly. And he said, Buzz, we have a problem. And I said, oh, what's the problem? He goes, well, on our way back from Europe tonight, President Clinton cornered one of my female flight attendants, which are also all Air Force, by the way. These are listed listed men and women who are Air Force. Cornered one of my flight attendants in a galley and sexually molested her. Oh. And like you can imagine, my first reaction is, oh, okay.
Yeah, right.
After all this is where we're going next. I said, well, what does she want? And he said, well, she's, you know, staff sergeant in the Air Force. She's married. She just had a baby. She doesn't want to come out as, you know, doesn't want to be on the Clinton hit list or be, you know, another bimbo eruption is the words that he used. Mm-hmm. And I said, he said, all she wants, and she's sitting in front of me, is an apology from President Clinton. So as Josh, as a young major, I had to walk down to the Oval Office the next morning at about 6:30 a.m. and confront President Clinton and tell him that I'd been called by the Air Force One pilot who works for President Clinton, mm-hmm. as does the Air Force One crew, and say that he needed to apologize to this young lady that he had accosted on Air Force One. And he could have cared less. He just said, okay, I'll apologize next time we're on Air Force One. So he did it. So I remember thinking, if that had been anybody in the military that had done that to another military female, mm-hmm. we would not only be court-martialed, we'd be breaking big rocks into small rocks in Leavenworth. So, you know, and that's when I remember walking out of the office, and I've been shot at by bullets in combat, Josh, mm-hmm. a million times. Mm-hmm. That was the hardest single moment in my lifetime, was having to walk down to the Oval Office and tell the president and commander in chief of the United States that he had sexually molested a woman and needed to apologize to her. So we did arrange that on Air Force One about 2 weeks later, and she was on the crew, and I got them together. And I remember sitting right outside the president's office in Air Force One, and he said, I'm sorry if I offended you. He didn't say, I'm sorry, I didn't mean it. He didn't anything. I'm sorry if I offended you. You're dismissed. And I thought, oh, man, this is the guy. So that's when I talk about no moral fiber, that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. And he thought he could get away with it, and he did yet again.
Wow. You know, you got to ask you, so you spent a lot of time with him, because you hear a story like that, and I just personally go, what kind of psyche do you have to have? Do that. Was he, when he was around the guys, was he kind of like, look, I played basketball in high school. I'm a wrestler. So I've heard locker room talk and stuff like that, kind of being quote unquote one of the boys. Was that the mentality that he kind of had around you guys, that you guys were all just kind of guys doing stuff? Or
Yeah, totally. And I mean, and it wasn't even just, I mean, when we would go to the golf course, he liked to play golf, as you know, as most people know. And I didn't get a chance to swing the clubs with him, but I was always in the cart behind him. Mm-hmm. With the football and all the communications equipment and the doctor and that kind of stuff. So he would just pull Secret Service guys over and say, hey, check her out. Or, hey, you know, what do you think? Mm-hmm. You know, that kind of thing. He was just doing that all the time. You know, I think I tried to psychoanalyze the guy in my 2 years there. And I lived with him for 2 years. And I really think that, you know, he came from a broken family and from a very small town in Arkansas, Hope, Arkansas. We actually went there a couple times together to see his then living mom, who's now passed. I think he was just a small town high school kid, tuba saxophone player, didn't play sports, was very smart, got into school in Harvard and did his thing and went overseas and did his thing and tried to stay out of the military, at the hardest he could, I think he was just a guy that was, he's super gregarious, which is why I liked being around him. He tells amazing, funny stories. I mean, and when he's not being presidential, he's the nicest guy in the world. Mm-hmm. And if he's not cheating on his wife or doing other things, but when he's being presidential, he's kind of an asshole. Mm-hmm. So I just think he was raised kind of expected someday to be the president. He was a JFK high school kid. And and I just think he climbed the ladder, and that's why he married Hillary, because she was also an attorney at the time and very successful with the Watergate stuff. And so I think that they were both just kind of a business relationship from the very beginning, a political association. I never saw a single moment of intimacy between them, no holding hands, no kisses. They had separate beds in the residence of the White House. So I've seen Hillary without makeup, and that's why I have PTSD.
It's interesting though. I have to ask this because I do think that there is a level of when women are stern and hard, they are kind of quote unquote bitchy. Right. Guys who are like that, they kind of get away. It's kind of almost a little more expected. How much of the Hillary Clinton stuff do you think she just had to have a hard edge in a time when women were really kind of, I mean, now we have women vice president, right. Often have women. She was the first one to really run for president, which is quite remarkable. Do you think a lot of this was kind of, she felt she had to be like this, or do you think that there really was, she just was at her core a vindictive person?
Well, I think the deal was when he got caught with Monica, and there were others that we won't go into, but when he got caught with Monica, she knew that her political future was threatened. Mm-hmm. So, I remember when right after the Monica Lewinsky thing hit the Drudge Report, the national press, they had all these crisis meetings, scandal meetings up in the residence, and I would attend some of them just to hear what was going on, and she was the one that at that moment, Josh, she became the co-president. Mm-hmm. And she basically said to him, you're not going to ruin my future. Mm-hmm. I'm going to support you in this, and you're going to do whatever the hell you can when I want to run, which he did when she ran for the Senate in New York. Mm-hmm. So it was always, kind of always a business relationship situation. He was a fantastic, and probably still is a fantastic politician. He can speak, he can riff, he doesn't need notes, teleprompters, none of that. He is just, when you meet Bill Clinton, you have met Bill Clinton. He shakes your hand hard, he looks you right in the eyes. She has none of that. She's not a public speaker, she's not nice, people know she's not nice. They flock to Bill and they hate Hill. And I think that's pretty accurate characterization.
Wow, yeah. Now, let me shift gears a little bit and talk to you about when you're holding the nuclear football, were you, I don't know the psyche of that because no one's ever had to actually use it, at least not for the last 50, 60, 70 years. Right. But at the same time, there's gotta be a level of anxiety to that.
Oh, sure. Knowing
that, so tell me, like, day to day, were there any times where you were really anxious in holding that, or was it kind of a lull of all times, or was at some point where you just kind of like, yeah, I'm holding the nuclear football?
No, every single day was on high alert. And so the only person that knows what's in the football is the military aide. And the only person that can get into the football is the military aide. So the way it's supposed to work is the president carries a set of nuclear codes, about a credit card size set of nuclear codes, which is kind of contained in a, you know, an outer pocket thing that they have to rip open. And then they read the codes through the military aide who is on the phone with National Military Command Center in the Pentagon, who then goes out to all the commands that have the nuclear subs, the bombers, the missile silos, the whole nine. So it's supposed to work that way. And I was always on edge. I mean, literally always on edge. There were a few times where we had fake. So we would get a phone call from NORAD or the Pentagon saying potential missile inbound from China, Russia, whatever. And we would scramble and get ready. And then it would be, okay, false target. So there was a couple times that happened. It was one time that Bill Clinton lost those codes, personally lost those codes, which had never happened in the history of the nuclear football or the military aid. Wow. So he didn't, and he didn't confess to it. And so he didn't tell me for several weeks, we think. And when he finally admitted it to me, the Pentagon wasn't prepared for that because they only change those things out every 2 or 3 months because you don't want to keep sending out a bazillion nuclear code messages to all the aircraft carriers and the, you know, just it's just not prudent. So anyway, he lost those codes. We never did find them. There was probably he couldn't remember how long it had been when I pressed him on it. It could have been up to 3 months that he didn't recall where they were, and he didn't confess it. And that's also happened to happen during all the Monica Lewinsky stuff. So the fact that he lost the codes during that, he knew he was probably going to be impeached, all that kind of stuff. So he took his eye off the ball, which is another reason why, another thing I talk about in dereliction.
Wow, man. So now your political affiliation then, does it, I mean, being there with Bill Clinton, did it change at all after seeing that?
Well, yes, it did. When I actually got into the White House, I was just kind of apathetic, probably leaned more right than left, but I didn't really vote. In fact, when I had my interview at the White House, they asked me if I'd voted for Clinton. I said, no, I didn't vote. This was in 92. I started seeing things every single day. I started talking to, you know, my peers and watching what Clinton was doing, wasn't doing. And so I kind of went way right at that point. I didn't say anything about it. I didn't let it affect my performance. Again, I was there to serve the office and not the man. I kept my mouth shut the entire time. I didn't, you know, I didn't say anything to anybody. I did one more assignment after the White House, which was being commander at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, which I absolutely loved. So I just got back to the Air Force and didn't say anything. And then again, I retired from the Air Force to go fly for Delta, and had all my buddies calling me saying, "Hey, why don't you write something?" And I'd never written anything before. I mean, I'd written how to fly in combat stuff, but I had never written anything creative, you know. So, I did it, and a publisher picked it up, and it became a bestseller. And I've been writing ever since. So it was just one of those things. Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. You know, as you're doing this, as you're looking now at what we're dealing with now politically.
Yeah.
I mean, we got essentially not necessarily directly involved, but two wars that are pretty significant in the world going on right now.
Right.
You know, I would say anybody who thinks that Joe Biden is working at full capacity is not being realistic. Right. But at the same time, we have a Donald Trump that is also up there. You know, is also up there and older. And on top of that is also sometimes you just wonder what he's thinking at the same time when he's saying the things that he's saying.
Right.
How is, as somebody who's been in the White House, seen the rigors of the job, right? I mean, you've been there 2 years. You saw how rigorous it is.
Right.
How concerned are you with how 2024 is shaping up?
Well, I think we only have two choices. I voted for Trump in 2020 and I will again. Because I think he can turn around a lot of what's gone wrong in this nation, especially the border, especially the economy, the schools. You know, I mean, he says some wacky shit. It's true. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But he's
hard, and it's hard to get past it.
It's one of the best things that ever happened to him was getting blocked on Twitter because he doesn't have that resource anymore.
Sure.
And he can come back any day now. He's been invited back by Elon Musk, but he's chosen not to because he's got True Social. But so, yeah, I think that looking at our options, right? I'm pragmatic. Looking at our options, I don't think we're going to survive another 4 years under Biden. I don't think Biden's going to survive another 4 years under Biden. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I don't think Kamala Harris is the answer either. I mean, I think that's a deficit if we get her on top of Biden. I just think Trump will walk in there again. You know, I think he's older. He's not older than Biden. He still walks 18 holes. You know, he doesn't drink. He says wacky stuff, but I like his policies. And they were way better for my family than Biden's policies have been. I'll put it that way, you know. So I'm looking at it from what kind of country do I want to leave to my kids and their kids? Mm-hmm. And I don't think that I want to leave them Biden country. I think I want to give us 4 years of Trump and then maybe hopefully somebody like DeSantis or, you know, get somebody more youthful into the position, somebody that's you know, that's got some governing experience on top of that. I think DeSantis is one of the two best governors, maybe three best governors in the country. So I didn't support him for president because I don't think he was ready yet. But I support Trump. And again, I cringe. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we're at a position right now, Josh, where our options are like, you know,
they're slim.
They're slim.
They're slim. As somebody who's a poli sci major and a lawyer who has just been interested in the process pretty much my whole adult life, just in the process of figuring it out, looking at the pipeline, I'm really more worried looking at the pipeline because there's just both on the Democratic side and on the Republican side, we're really low on people who are true leaders. I mean, say what you want about Donald Trump. I mean, he gets people to follow him. I mean, like, and that's the thing is that, like, it's shocking to me. I'm not a Trump supporter. I'm not a fan. I do like some of his policies. There's others I don't. And I just can't get past a lot of the stuff that he says. Not a Biden supporter either. It puts me in a bad position. I voted third party. But, like, you know, but looking beyond Donald Trump, you look and you go, who on the Republican side is going to be the next person? I thought DeSantis maybe was the guy, you know. I think he showed some weakness during this primary that I didn't expect. And and then on the Democratic side, I've always, even though I lean conservative, I don't see anybody on the Democratic side that interests me. The closest thing I had was Andrew Yang.
I
found him to be very interesting. But other than him, I haven't found anybody on the Democratic side that I go, well, tell me more about what you're saying. You know, they don't. And so it's hard looking forward as, you know, is this the, you hear every 4 years, this is the most important election we've ever had. I don't know if this one's it, but I think 2028 definitely is. You're going to get two brand new people running.
Right.
It's going to be very, very interesting at that point.
Yeah. So here's I agree with everything you said. But here's my point, having worked at the White House and having been actually ran for Congress as a Republican in Sacramento back in 2020.
Well, nobody can win Republican around here.
I got close. I got close. Yeah. But I didn't win because I got zero support from the GOP.
Who are you running against?
I was running against Ami Bera at the time.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a tough one to crack. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he doesn't do anything. He makes a lot of money. He doesn't do anything. But here's the problem with our political process right now on both sides is we have created this industry of consultants, lobbyists. And I can speak to this personally, having gone through the pains of having a consultant, consultants, lobbyists, and people and politicians who are making big bucks. Not just their $174,000 they make, you know, being a congressman or congresswoman, but they can speak and make millions. Mm-hmm. And we've created this subclass of an industry that it's really hard to penetrate. Mm-hmm. You've got to have a lot of money. And if you don't have a lot of money, you're not going to get support. And if you don't have support, you can't really run for office successfully. So we've created this problem that I think really again, you know, I think one of Trump's greatest attributes is he wants to break that up. You know, that's one of the things that I like about him. He didn't come up through that. It's not like he was raised in the farm system and came up through, you know, single A, double A, triple A ball. He walked in on first, you know, in the first year, his first election, and won. So he's not beholden to a lot of people, which I like, because everybody else is. I mean, and it's on both sides. I have friends that have been in Congress. I have friends that run for Congress, and they feel the exact same way, that it's impenetrable to be a normal person with ideas in an education and have solid policies. It's almost impossible. You've got to be somebody really unique to break how the GOP does things and DNC does things. So they're almost a uni party, and they're aligned, and they do a lot of things the exact same way. And that's a problem for all Americans, no matter what you think.
Yeah. You know, and it's so interesting. It's hard to, I mean, well, first of all, like, you've run for Congress, you've seen them run. You have friends in Congress. Morality does not seem to be a huge factor in politics. Has that been your experience?
Yes. It's all about the dollar. I mean, it's sad but true. It's all about the money. And it starts at the ground floor. I don't care if you're running for a local city mayor or you know, your school district, all the way up to running for the Senate. It's you have to have people who want to give you a lot of money. And they really don't care about your ideas. They care about the R or the D next to your name, and that's and who's popular. So if you're running against three other R's, which I did, and beat all three of them, which watered the vote down considerably, but people are going to vote for the R that has, and the same is true of the D. Whoever has the money behind them, the support, and they don't care what they think. Like Almy Bear is a perfect example there in Sacramento. He doesn't do anything. I mean, he changes post office names and you know, dedicates libraries. I mean, he, you know, and votes for far leftist stuff, and but he gets away with it. And we're not going to get him out till he wants to be gotten out. I mean, that's just how this. Once you get in there, dude, you're there. Nancy Pelosi is a good example of that. Chuck Schumer, Joe Biden was, you know, 50 years ago. I mean, once you get there, unless you want to leave, you're there, because you are propped up with amazing money and opportunity, and you get to be on TV for free every day if you want to do that, and you get to hobnob around D.C. and eat at Cafe Milano, which most of them do. So yeah, we're kind of screwed. I mean, quite frankly,
Man, it's hard to hear. So now tell me, throughout your time, let's spend a little bit of time. We have a little bit of time left. I want to ask you, being a pilot, what did that mean to you in the military?
This is going to probably make you laugh too. When I was in grad school, I went to the Air Force recruiter to see if I could get into law school, because they had they had a program at the time that they would pay your law school if you gave them 4 years upon completion of law school. So I got into Georgetown and I got into North Carolina. Okay. And I thought, because I was going to Virginia Tech at the time in grad school. So I went to the recruiter to get into, to take the law school program. And he goes, well, you know, Reagan had just been elected his first term. Mm-hmm. So I went to the recruiter and he goes, you know, Reagan is pro-military and we need a lot of pilots, and we'd love for you to take the pilot test too. Take the pilot test and see what you think. I had never flown an airplane in my life. Mm-hmm. So I took this test and did fairly well. And they called me up and said, we want you to go to pilot training instead. So I said, well, if I screw up, can I go to law school afterwards? They said, oh, yeah. So the very first day I got into an airplane in pilot training, I was just like exhilarated. Mm-hmm. And I thought, this is kind of what I want to do. This is fun. And, you know, of course, you're around a bunch of other squadron mates that are all doing the same thing for the first time. And you all get really close and you go out and drink beers. And But then, you know, after a year of pilot training, and I loved it. I mean, it's a grueling year. We lost about half of our class. We had a couple crashes, but the other half got just kicked out, washed out. But then one of my first experiences in the Air Force was flying into combat in Grenada during President Reagan's invasion of Grenada. Wow. And getting shot at and going, wow, this is kind of cool. I mean, and I was single. I didn't care. You know, I was young. I was just wanted to fly airplanes, and I flew airplanes all over the world, and I just really enjoyed it. I loved it. I was good at it, and that's why when I finished 20 years in the Air Force with about 8,000 hours, I went to fly for Delta Airlines for another 16 years because I enjoyed flying. But I still do occasionally now. I'll go up in a Cessna. Just every once in a while, but it's expensive and I really don't have that much time, but I loved, you know, flying. It's probably the best job in the world. The office view, you can't beat the office view, and people you meet and the places you stay are phenomenal. So, So I look back on it fondly, but I'm glad I'm not still doing it.
Yeah. Wow. Well, let me ask you, I ask everybody three questions. We're about out of time. I appreciate everything that you've said. I asked three questions to everybody. First question is, what would you say, you've lived a very successful life, what's the biggest success that you've ever had?
Success, like an individual success?
Yeah.
Yeah, being a squadron commander in the Bosnian War and flying into Bosnia every single day and having every single one of my guys and girls come back. That was there for 3 months, flying out of Frankfurt, Germany. And just that stress. Talk about that stress, being a commander and knowing your guys are flying into combat and you flying them in. I would always fly the first one in and the last one out. But knowing that we had, you know, 180 people that we had to get home to Northern California, to Travis, after three months getting shot at daily. So that's probably my most favorite, my proudest achievement. Yeah.
Awesome. Next question is, what's your biggest failure and what did you learn from it?
Biggest failure was my first marriage. Got married too early, Air Force marriage, and that didn't last long. And then I was single for several years, and then met my now wife in 1995 in Japan. She's from Chico, though. She's a Chico State girl.
Oh, okay. So she was a partier.
Oh, yeah. She's still pretty much a partier. In fact, she's working at the Reagan Library right now. She'll be home soon. But nice. Yeah, so she's a Chico girl. And so we met in Japan. She was over there on an internship thing. And I was flying over there. And somebody set us up on a blind date. And 29 years later, three kids later. So biggest failure was my first marriage. But one of my other successes, I should have said this first. My most significant success was my wife, Nicole.
That's awesome. Well, you know, do you think, though, that having that experience with the first marriage made you a better husband for the second?
Oh, 100%. 100%. And, you know, one of the problems with the first marriage was my ex didn't want children. And I wanted kids. And I got to the point where I was just kind of, well, that's never going to happen. And then I ran into my wife, and she's much younger than me. So we've had three, one graduated, one's in college and one's in high school. In fact, my high school kids actually right now doing a mission trip in Kampala, Uganda.
Wow.
Yeah. He's a big sports kid. He's basketball and volleyball out here in Southern California. So
that's right. My son is, he's graduating high school right now. We're Mormon, so he'll be serving a mission in about a year. But he played basketball. He's 6'3", plays the guitar. The kid just doesn't, he's just good at everything.
You know where he's going on mission yet?
No, he won't know yet. He's going to attend a community college for a year and then he'll submit his papers and then they tell him where he's going. So
yeah. We've got several Mormon, my buddy, my son Chase has got several Mormon friends and, they're all setting themselves up for the next step. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So last question. So one day you're going to pass away. When you do, there'll be a funeral and someone will give a eulogy. What is the one thing you hope somebody says about you in your eulogy?
Oh, man, I just gave my mom's 2 months ago. And my dad died a year ago. My mom died 2 months ago. And those are both like the hardest things I've ever done. I would say just he's just a good dude. He was always a good dude, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm a nice guy. I like being nice to people. I was raised right. Mm-hmm. You know, my dad was in the Air Force for 33 years, so I grew up all over the world. Went to 8 schools in 12 years, K through 12, and then I went to 3 colleges. So I liked people, and I just hope that I'm remembered for not being a douchebag.
You don't strike me as a douchebag. You strike me as a straight shooter, and I appreciate it. So where can people find your books, and where can people, if they want to follow you, where can they follow you?
Okay, my books, like I said, I've got 4. They're on Amazon.com is the best place to find them. Just search Buzz Patterson, and they'll all pop up. I could sell them books, but my website charges way more than what Amazon does. So okay. I don't do that anymore. I don't even take books to speaking. I'm speaking in Monterey in 3 nights. And so Amazon's the way to go. And if people want me to sign them, then let me know and I'll and ship them to me and I'll sign them and send them back.
Awesome.
I'm on all the social media suspects. X is where I'm probably most profound and probably most seen. Yeah. So at Buzz Patterson, pretty easy. My Facebook is at Buzz Patterson, and my Instagram is at Real Buzz Patterson. So, so hit me up. I'm active. I'm funny. I sometimes I'm a little rude, when it comes to politics, but, I don't hold back. And I also talk a lot about my experiences and, you know, and people I've known over the years and a lot of aviation stuff. So it's not all politics. I show a lot of aviation videos and pet videos. So it's awesome. It's not all hardcore stuff.
That's awesome. Well, Buzz, I appreciate you coming on. You said you give me 45 minutes. And I want to keep you your time. You're already over, but I appreciate it. For those who have listened, follow Buzz. It's been a pleasure. Let's do this again sometime. I really
appreciate it. Yes, sir. Anytime, Josh. It's always a pleasure. I love talking about all the random stuff. So let's do it.
Yeah. Right on. All right. Thank you. We'll talk to you later.
Okay. See you, Josh.